Listen and stream the only talk radio, Freedom 106.5, for the only talk that matter.
We've been discussing crime on the program for as long as we can remember. And as a nation, one of the things, not just us, but across the world, but one of the statistics used many times to gauge the crime situation, homicides. Joining us this morning on our program is the head of the Homicide Division, Senior Superintendent Rishi Singh. Good morning to you, and welcome to our program.
Thank you so much, Satish. Good morning to you as well.
Nice to have you with us here this morning. We talk about it all the time. And many times when we speak about it, there are people who speak based on emotion, people who speak not necessarily having the information, the statistics, the understanding of what's going on and why it's going on. And this morning, we're hoping very much that after our discussion, people have a clearer idea of some of these issues. Before we get into the discussion, I'll allow you to familiarize our listeners with yourself. Tell us a bit about yourself, your length in the service, and some of the things that you're involved in at this point in time.
Sure. Good morning to the listening and perhaps even viewing public. I'm not sure if we actually
are streaming. Yes,
we're streaming. Quite simply, my name is Rishi Singh. I am the Senior Superintendent of the Homicide Bureau currently. I have worked in Trinidad and Tobago Police Service for over 26 years. And during that time, I have functioned in various capacities, largely organized crime, white-collar crime, violent crime, criminal investigations department, and now heading the homicide.
That's quite a career, and it has allowed you to gain experience in some very interesting fields. We speak about all of these, but this morning we are here to talk specifically on the issue of homicide. Last year, the country recorded its highest ever homicide figure. And that's not something that anyone can bask in, regardless of what your views are. It's a sad statistic for any country to have recorded its highest ever murder figure. The Prime Minister said something very interesting at the opening of the two-day CARICOM summit. And he said that the current trends are worrying when it comes to homicides this year, and it's proving to be a challenge. The first quarter is gone. What are our statistics like following the first quarter of this year?
Well, as at this morning, our current homicide figure is 174. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, I had prepared the statistics for today, and overnight, we had four more homicides. And the PM is right, it is a worrying statistic.
When we hear of the murders, we immediately think that it's a signal as to whether we're dealing with crime or we're not dealing with crime. But there are specific circumstances that crimes are committed and that murders are committed in. And you have various classifications. Before we get into the next question, what are the classifications, the various types of killings that we have? Because I remember we were having a whole discussion about what's a homicide and what's a murder and how you classify them and that kind of thing. What are the various classifications for the untimely death of an individual?
Well, generally, the whole aspect of untimely death really can fall into several categories. Homicides is the broadest category, the death of a human. Murder is a very specific category, the unlawful killing of a human being, malice aforethought, with the intention to kill. Mm. Then you have the context of manslaughter, where a person dies because of the recklessness, not necessarily the intention to kill, but the foreseeability that death is a likely consequence. Then you have the whole issue of self-defense related killings, which is neither murder or manslaughter, but a person did it out of defense of self, where we usually have inquests in relation to those deaths, just to confirm it doesn't fall into those two unlawful categories. And then you have, we have unclassified deaths in the sense that it's not natural, but one cannot tell whether there was, in fact, a crime committed. It could be accidental or otherwise. Mm-hmm. You know, and that kind of thing. In the context of homicides, of murders, of course, we can also classify in relation to probable cause of the particular murder, what really, in an essence, motivates the individual who is the perpetrator to cause the death of the other person,
mm-hmm.
then, well, then we can classify according to various other categories in terms of the gender of the person, the age of the person. We categorize in terms of the nationality of the persons. But those are not really legal classifications, of course. They are generally administrative classifications to perhaps help us put into context what are the probabilities of persons of various characteristics becoming victims themselves.
We're having a raging discussion in the country at this point in time about home invasions.
Yes.
And about the rights of a home owner or somebody within that kind of setting to defend themselves and how far people can actually take it. The opposition leader made an interesting comment about arming citizens more and bringing new legislation to deal with home invasions. I can't remember the terminology she used at this point in time, but that's something that we're discussing. And I think it's valuable information because you have a population that is at its wit's end. You are hearing of these heinous crimes. Some of them go unreported and people are scared. And people are being advised by persons who don't necessarily have the authority to advise them to arm themselves with whatever they can to defend themselves, defend their loved ones. Now, it's a tricky situation because we've seen in the past where persons who thought they were defending themselves found themselves on the wrong side of the law. So what's your advice to people? How far can someone take it? And in a split-second situation, where do you draw the line between defending yourself and committing an act that can see you charged?
Now, you have isolated the incident of home invasion at the beginnings of this question.
Mm-hmm.
A man's home is his castle. But that said, the law of self-defense is really predicated on proportionate reaction to the threat. So your act of self-defense can only be predicated upon a reasonable and proportionate response to a threat that presents itself. So once an individual decides that, look, the particular issue that they are faced with is life-threatening, they must act no more than is required to defend themselves in that circumstance. An honest mistaken belief, even at that moment, perhaps is correct, but the safest place is to actually decide, and decided in a very minute amount of time. And that is even an issue that police officers are faced with, mm-hmm. in relation to how we respond to persons who threaten the police. The ultimate test is reasonable and proportionate response. And because of the diversity of circumstances, certainly if you there are many, many possibilities.
Yeah.
So, unless you have an example that you want me to reflect upon, I will.
Well, okay. Let's create a scenario.
Sure.
I'm at home with my loved ones, and two men decide they want to come into the house. Now, we've seen the violence with which home invasions they're characterized now. So it's not just about coming and taking up my valuables and leaving. It's about coming into my home and brutalizing my family before they leave. If in a situation like that, I find an option where I can take something and kill one of these men because I believe that they're not just here to rob, but they may assault my wife or my child or somebody else, what happens to me in a situation like that?
Well, certainly, in the first instance, your advice would be to reinforce your doors because you are aware that they're trying to come in. Reinforce your doors and try to make communication with law enforcement. That is the first most reasonable step that you can take. When you look outside and you see whether they are armed, certainly in these circumstances, one would expect that, as I said, reasonable and proportionate action. If you have something that you can use to disarm them just before they come into the premises and that kind of thing, certainly you would know your circumstances. You have other relatives, you you engage them, you can engage your neighbors. And I'm saying that based on the circumstances that you have presented, you're seeing them right. coming in. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are instances when you don't see them coming and your opportunity to react is significantly limited. So the thing is that one has to also understand, perhaps in those circumstances, when you two are actually overpowered and decide your strategy for just seeing this instance off and then making as much observation as is possible that will help law enforcement treat with the issue of investigation and prosecution when the time comes.
Mm-hmm. It's never one of those situations where you can really assess in your mind because you're faced with fear. This terror comes in and in many instances people react and don't think because your human instinct kicks in. You want to defend yourself. You want to prevent your family from going through what you know is going to be hell afterwards for them to have to deal with. We've seen instances where persons who are armed with legal firearms have found themselves on the other side of the law. In that persons have come into their homes and some of these persons have been, after retaliating and shooting and killing some people, that there's an investigation and we see them being charged. How does a situation like that come about? Because the average individual listening in becomes incensed and they are angry now when they are told that someone who has a licensed firearm and is defending their home now becomes they're charged with something arising out of that incident. And many people call and express the frustration that they can't understand why that takes place. What causes the differentiation between defense and an act of aggression that turns into a charge? Where is that line drawn?
The line is actually drawn, as I said before, in the context of your actions being disproportionate to the threat. Mm-hmm. So say, for instance, the person is actually unarmed and you have decided that you're going to use your firearm. That is, you know, the beginnings of the difference. But I will admit that in my experience, and certainly my recent experiences, mm-hmm. is that it's infrequent
right.
where licensed firearm holders in engaging a reasonable threat, they find themselves on the other side okay. of the law. That's my very recent experience. But I know of older experiences mm-hmm. where the actions were definitely disproportionate in the sense that the person wasn't armed in the way in which you explained, and the evidence didn't support that your submissions.
Mm-hmm.
And that is an important feature because remember, as objective inquirers into facts, we would look at the circumstances in its entirety. And we understand that fear itself, as you explained, is a seriously aggravating factor in the way we magnify threats,
mm-hmm.
and especially in the current environment. But ultimately, the test of proportionality really rests with the jury to decide whether the actions of the person. And, you know, sometimes it's unfortunate that the instant that you have to reflect upon your circumstance, a jury is not necessarily bound by that time factor, and they yeah. can factor in different things. So all these are questions of fact and the way people perceive things. But generally, the test really is defined by that issue of proportionate.
From what you're saying and these recent incidents and everything else, would I be correct to infer that these licensed firearm or holders have been responsible in how they've treated with situations that confronted them?
I'd have to say that those that we have interacted with, surely,
okay.
yes.
That's great information because you have a whole raging discussion on another side about legal firearms and arming the population. But let's get back to classifying these killings. For the first quarter, because we're trying to map what's going on and what we can expect at the end of the year. These trends continue. What are we looking at when it comes to gang-related, drug-related, domestic, and so on?
So I have some statistics available here, which I'll read. So the probable cause, we've categorized them as follows. Altercation, revenge, gang, rape, robbery, drug, domestic, intimate, domestic, non-intimate, line of duty killings, relationship motivated killings, unknown, and mistaken identity. So for the year so far, and So I've gone beyond the first quarter.
Okay.
But I can tell you the first quarter figures, just as a matter of reporting, is that we have had 141 up to the end of the first quarter, which was March. However, for this moment, up to this morning, like I said, we had four more last night, and we have moved to 174. So in the context of the probable cause of altercations, we have 14. Revenge killings, we have 12. Gang-related, we have 78. Robbery, 15. Drug-related incidents, 18. Domestic intimate, 2. Domestic non-intimate, 1. Line of duty, 0. Relationship motivated, 0. Unknown, 34. Because we're still working on the probable causes for those that happened last night. And basically, that is how we categorize, and that is the cumulative figure there would add up to the 170.
Mm. So we still see from the information presented that the, that a lot of our killings are related to criminal activity, gangs, and
oh yes, by far. The vulnerable lifestyles that persons actually choose by choosing to become part of a criminal enterprise, you find that is remains our greatest vulnerability as a population. People choosing life of crime, and with that there's the consequence and possibilities of death.
There are some other questions that we need to get into. From the statistics you've presented, we're up to 170-something, you
174,
said, taking into consideration what took place last night. But are there trends that we are seeing in terms of these killings? Are we seeing increases in certain groups, decreases in certain groups? What are the statistics saying to us?
Well, the statistics and the trends remain generally the same as last year. So, and you have trends in context, you know, so certainly in the context of the probable cause, the general features remain the same. So the vulnerabilities from last year remain the vulnerabilities from this year. Gang and drug-related issues remain our high numbers. Altercations and revenge find themselves increasing over the years simply because persons find there are challenges in resolving disputes in a very, very civil way. So sometimes what could be resolved by a simple discussion, persons either during the altercation take conclusive steps to the person's life right away, or they leave that and hold that grudge in mind and come back and do some revenge issues at a later point in time.
Mm-hmm.
So largely I'd say, if I had to say anything from a psychosocial perspective as a trend, certainly it would be that persons are having greater challenges resolving conflict in a very civil way, and they decide that, look, the value, the life of somebody is generally of no value to them, and they decide that, look, I can now extinguish that person's light.
That points to a real lack of respect for life, and a lack of respect for the law on the other side, because it suggests that for you to take this action, you're not concerned about consequences. And consequences are not necessarily high on your mind, because people weigh consequences before they do things.
Yes.
And that's a fact. If you know the possibility of you being brought to justice in a speedy manner for doing this thing, it makes you think a million times before you get it done. But we've seen that we have a real problem with violence, and it's played out. There are many simple things that you see on social media that descend into violence. School violence is just a reflection of what's taking place with the adult population as well. You have traffic incidents, minor little traffic incidents turning into big, big fights, and people getting stabbed and all that kind of thing. Out of these, we have a real problem as a country with treating with violence and how we deal with it, but that's another discussion. How are we doing when it comes to detecting these crimes, these murders, and solving them?
Such is, unfortunately, our detection rate right now is just at 12.9% for the year. And our detection rate for last year is now closer to 20%. And the reason why you have such fluidity is that, remember, we're still in just only past the first quarter of the year. So the inquiries that we have that are ongoing at the moment, we expect that they would have a culmination in the investigations later on in the year, and our detection rate would move higher up. The detection rate last year is influenced by the continued work that we do. And because the statistic has ended for last year, the successes of detection would now be faced with a fixed figure,
right.
And it would rise.
I understand what you're saying.
That is, it doesn't mean that 20%, 22%, 12% is something that the TTPS is certainly proud of and willing to stay in acceptance of. But that is just the reality that we have at this time. And of course, a number of things affect the detection rate. The chief amongst them is the availability of evidence. And that is our greatest challenge in the context of dealing with the homicides generally.
Yeah, that has been a sore point for a long period of time. Because there are some people who would suggest that Trinidad and Tobago is the place to commit a murder. Because your chances of being apprehended first are very, very low. You have an 87%. If we're saying that we're up 12.7% detection, means that you have an 87% chance of getting away. That's the flip side to the... I mean, it's an uncomforting reality, but that's what it is. If you have a 12.7% chance of being caught, it means that you have an 80-something% chance of getting away scot-free. What do we need to enhance that detection rate, to take it up? What are some of the things that could possibly help us? Because we hear all the time that the public needs to play a greater role, that civil society and all of these groups and everybody else, they need to help. But a 12.7% detection rate leaves a lot to be desired. Now, there may be factors for that, as you said, lack of evidence, but what can we do? Are there things that we need to legislate for? Are there different things? Do the police need more resources? Does the public need to play a greater part? What is needed?
Right. Now, because there are different streams of things that we can identify as great contributors to the lack of evidence, one would have to just reflect on individual streams of things.
Right.
So say, for instance, in the context of the large amount of killings that we have that are gang and drug-related, you would find that in the context of that detection, you would see that the detection for those would be very, very low. So for drug-related crimes and gang-related crimes, we are at 8%. When we have domestic violence crimes, you will find that the detection is closer to 60%. Where you have incidents where you have altercations, your chances of evidences have a detection rate of 33%. For issues like robbery that we have 26%. So when you add them together and you get the averages, the issue of the gang and drug related is actually what causes us to become significantly low. So in the context of an analysis as to why gang and drug related crimes you have the lower detection rate, it simply comes because of two main factors. One, in the context of a killing at that instant, you would find that your victim suspect contact is minimal. And two, you would find in such communities the levels of intimidation are significantly higher. So despite the fact that you would have general knowledge as to who is behind this, willing persons to come forward is significantly lower. In your domestic matters, you see that we're closer to 60%. The reason is that victim suspect contact is much higher.
Mm-hmm.
And relatives would be willing to account for the wrongdoing of their significant connections there. So if we have to identify what would impact our detection rate the greatest, it is simply that we need to have more courage in communities to stand up against these lawless individuals and say what you see and let us take charge and responsibility for what's going on in our communities and cause persons to account. Another thing that I've observed over the years is that long ago, persons, when they do, their conscience would bother them and they would much more readily account for the wrong that they have done. But as we evolve, or I should say as we devolve, we actually are regressing to a place where it seems that we are unconscionable. So I would do a wrong and I would take every step in the world not to account for it. And that is part of what is going on, the way we depreciate as a people.
Yeah, I've spoken about that. And I've said that, you know, coming out of news and looking at certain things from a different way, we have a breed of criminal today that is vastly different from what we had in years gone by. In years gone by, there were unspoken codes that criminals would operate under. They come for a target, they deal with the target, and they leave. Nobody else, you can have 100 people around, they deal with the target. But now you have a brand of criminal that doesn't care. They come for the target and anybody else who is there, it's collateral damage. And they operate with impunity. Normally, we would have had these things taking place in the night. It's any time of the day or night at this point in time. And the violent nature with which they're carrying out their crimes suggests that we're dealing with a different breed of criminal whose perspectives are totally different from what we were accustomed to. These codes and these rules by which they operated have gone out the window. We've spoken about detection. And for those of you now joining our interview, we're speaking here this morning with the head of Homicide Division, that Senior Superintendent Rishi Singh. What about prosecution and conviction?
Well,
I know it's a long, drawn-out process.
That's correct. So, remember, we have matters that generally take in excess of 7 years to move from the time we charge to the end, and sometimes as much as 10, 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
So the current way in which the data is connected, it's really difficult to say, to measure the conviction rate for that particular year because of how dispersed such information is. It's not an impossibility, but it's something that we will be working on in terms of the way we connect the data at the end of the prosecution to the data that we have existing in the service at this point in time to the moments of charging. Now, the thing is, in the context of charging an individual, our process is that we do the investigation, compile the material, consult with the DPP, who gives the instructions to charge. Any advice to initiate prosecution really is considered on the balance of probabilities of a reasonable conviction.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the course of a trial, the evidence is actually beyond a reasonable doubt. And remember, we have a lot of procedural issues in between there, the way even perhaps the way the tribunal of fact, which in many instances is a jury, actually perceive the evidence in the end. And so you find with that disparity, you do have a figure at the conviction time that does not necessarily match your detection figure. You know, that would account for the disparity that is expected to exist. But I can tell you, I can't tell you the figure because we don't store the data like that at this point in time.
But that might be interesting. I remember Ramesh Lawrence Maharaj speaking about this because we had the whole discussion about murder and hanging, and that was a long time ago. And he, I think if I might be mistaken, I hope I'm not, that he had made the analogy that the detection rate was very, very, the conviction rate rather, was low, 2-3% or whatever it is of the persons who would have been charged. And he went on to explain exactly why that took place. And it's in tandem with what you're saying. What you have is you have 12 people, 10 or how many of us, sitting down adjudicating on facts that are presented almost 2 decades after an event took place. And they have to form in their minds whether or not it is as is being presented. And many times it might be difficult to do that. Guns and the number of homicides that we've had for the year. I don't know if you would have the statistic for last year or this year thus far. Let's deal with this year. How many of the homicides that we've seen, the 170-something, were homicides that resulted out of guns being used as the murder weapon?
So, all 4 last night were firearm-related.
Mm-hmm.
And as of yesterday, we were 149, so 153 out of the 170. So, we just over just about 90%.
Wow. That's an alarming statistic.
And that has been a consistent trend over the years.
But it's been an alarming statistic.
Between 80 to 90%.
For a number of years. It means that if you are, unfortunately, the victim of murder in this country, chances are you're going to be shot dead. We had a two-day symposium that spoke about all of these things, about the guns, where they're coming from, and the concerted effort to try to deal with them. But these figures that you're presenting here highlight how bad we've failed to get these guns off the streets. I mean, it might sound harsh, but that's the reality. When you have a homicide figure that says to you that 90% of the people who are killed were killed using illegal firearms, is there a differentiation between, were any of these legal firearms used in any of these killings this year?
Not as far as I can recall.
So all of these are illegal firearms. They continue to be our biggest problem. Do we have statistics regarding women and children who were murdered killed this year?
Yes. So for 2023, we have had 5 children being killed. And we have roughly, oh my goodness, just a second.
Mm-hmm.
I do have the statistics for women, and it would be 18.
18 women and
18, 5. 2 last night, 16 before.
Well, I know we've had the entire discussion about women and the propensity for violence against them. We're running out of time because I have you just for a limited time this morning, up until just before 7.
Sure.
But I would like you to come back, because there are things that I think the public needs to hear about, and this is not about casting aspersion or blame, it's about understanding what's going on. And I think as a population, it would influence many of the discussions that we have, and could possibly see us formulating our own ideas about how we treat with it. And that's the final question that I'm going to ask you here this morning. What are we doing to deal with these homicides that we've had 170 or how many ever for the year already? If we continue at this trend, we're looking at almost the same figure as last year, probably even more. What are we doing about it?
Well, we are relentlessly pursuing investigation into the matters. We are looking to foster relationships with vulnerable communities, hopefully to influence the way they perceive their environment and to help them take charge of their surroundings in such a way that would cause them to support our investigations. We are, as you may well know, it's public that the Police Service and the Forensic Science Center are looking to improve systems between them for us to increase the availability of scientific evidence that would support the other limbs of evidence to lead to greater detections. We are in a state of constant review of matters to ensure that leads are properly followed up, and we are constantly in review of systems. We are engaged in the constant development of the detectives at the Bureau to ensure that the best approach is taken in relation to the actual investigations. So there are a number of things that are occurring simultaneously. But I think the thing that would have the biggest impact overall is that as a group, we have to give up our anxieties and take charge of these things. You mentioned emotions at the beginning. We have to set aside emotional approaches and come up with very logical, professional approaches.
That's where we're going to have to leave it, because news is next. TTPS Head of Homicide Division, Senior Superintendent Rishi Singh. I want to thank you for being here this morning. It's been a really interesting discussion. And as I said, I think we need a part two to delve into some of the other issues that probably we just glossed over this morning. Homicides definitely concerns all of us, and it should. When we have the number that we see each and every single year, and discussions like these, as I said, are very, very, very necessary. Thank you once again for being with us.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.